Hello and welcome to another SportsPro podcast. My name is James Emmett. I'm the editorial director of SportsPro. With me is Owen Connolly, the editor of SportsPro. Hello, Owen.
Hello, James.
And blast from the past, David Cushnam, global communications manager at Replicom. Hello, David.
Hi, James. Hi, Owen. Thanks for having me back.
Indeed. A reinvigorated, refreshed podcast. First thing on the agenda, I suppose, Sebastian Coe, the new president of the International Association of Athletics Federations, a resounding victory?
Yes, although some people I think were saying that it was closer than expected. We're speaking on the day of the election and as...
Probably the day after the election, Chinese time.
Correct. Mm-hmm. But I think, as many people have pointed out, that the hard work starts now.
Indeed, yes. And he defeated Sergei Bubka, of course. 112 votes to 93, I think, something like that.
Yeah, as someone pointed out, if 12 people had voted differently, then Bubka would have won, which is slightly disingenuous because it doesn't actually reveal the margin of how many people did vote for Seb Coe. Bubka on as a vice president, he was canny enough to see that he was very much the second horse in this race.
Although there was a suggestion that I saw from a sports industry luminary on Twitter earlier on this morning, who was suggesting that perhaps Bubka's decision to stand as a vice president as well may have actually split his vote, because some voters would have seen a potential dream scenario of Coe as leader, Bubka as essentially his deputy. So it will be interesting now to see what Bubka does and whether he continues in a prominent role within the IAAF. Because let's remember, he was a defeated candidate in the last International Olympic Committee presidential election in 2013. He's now also lost this one. He's still an IOC member. He's still a senior member of the IOC. But it will be interesting to see now what his next move is, and maybe there will be another Coe versus Bubka presidential battle in about a decade's time, if they one or either of them thinks that they can stand as Thomas Bach's replacement as president of the IOC. Because of course, one of the things that one of the perks of the job, if you like, for Seb Coe in his new role as IAAF president is that next year he will almost certainly be elected as a member of the IOC, which is sort of one thing that has been missing from his sports politics CV.
I think that's as good as a dead certainty, isn't it, that he'll be elected. And I saw today five British members of the IOC now, the most from any one nation.
And also the senior roles now, the presidents of the International Athletics Federation and also the UCI, plus WADA, the World Anti-Doping Authority, all Brits, all Britons now. So really Britain back at the top table of sports politics.
And with a very pliant media, they're ready to serve their every whim and deliver their every PR line. I think the other thing about Bubka, if he does stay on as a vice president in a prominent role, is it obviously strengthens the front bench, if you like, for Seb Coe. You know, he will have a busy couple of years for the IAAF. Obviously, the latest doping story has flared up in the last few weeks, but I think what it's also highlighted when you talk about the budget that the IAAF has for all of its activities is that athletics is a sport that really needs to adapt to 21st century industry practices and needs to find a way of converting what is, you know, a very prominent role within the sporting landscape and deliver some of the resources that it needs to do its job.
But if we've learned anything from recent history, Lord Coe is, of course, a very smooth media operator and certainly will negotiate choppy waters with a calm hand on the tiller, I'd imagine. Although we did see a flare-up recently when these doping allegations came to light, where he was... I mean, was that out of character for Lord Coe?
I think it was probably quite a nifty bit of electioneering, and I think in, you know, he wanted to distance himself almost from the British press view of things, let's remember he was facing an election where there were 200 plus voters from all parts of the world, and anybody who's looked at Sebco's Twitter feed over the last 9 months to a year will have seen him popping up with photos and enjoying his visits to all sorts of far-flung corners of the world. So I think he very acutely understood that this was a global election, and in order to win, he would have to take a more global view. And I think it was probably quite a calculated piece of election campaigning. But what it does do is it means he probably has a little bit of reputational damage to repair in the eyes of the British public, who have obviously read and seen his comments and also know of him as the man who delivered the Olympics and as this Olympic champion. And there was an element of shooting the messenger.
Mm. Well, I think what's interesting as well is that he now has to shift his stance a bit. I mean, he's spent, where are we now, 3 years being kind of our Seb, who delivered the games, who, you know, whatever he'd done in the past, whatever run-ins he'd had with people or whatever people thought about his politics, perhaps in the 1990s, was all completely buried under the enormous success that he had delivering the Olympic Games. And he, I think, will be aware that if you're going to be the president of an international federation as prominent as the IAAF, life is not going to be as easy. And he needed to show that he's the leader of that organisation first and foremost, if that's the job that he wants to do.
Sorry, David, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think there's probably two other things to mention. One, he can't do this on his own. This is whether it's the doping issue or the need to improve
the marketing side of things,
which is a huge problem for the IAAF. I mean, we are talking what, 3-4 days before the start of the World Athletics Championships, and you would expect a bit more interest in it,
a bit more buzz.
He can't do it on his own, and I think one thing to watch out for will be the selection of the new General Secretary of the IAAF.
Because, of course, SR Gabriel is the current General Secretary, is departing with Lamine Diack, outgoing President.
Yes, indeed. And I think that's a key role, because that's really a lot of the day-to-day management of the organisation. And what still is, you know, by some standards, a fairly small international organisation. I think the other thing to say is, chalk this one off as another triumph for Mike Lee's Vero Communications.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
And
Brian Cookson in 2013, Lamine Diack, in fact, a re-election a couple of years before that, and now, of course, Seb Coe. Who's he got next in the next election? Michel Platini.
Indeed, and it was interesting that I'm not sure if they still are working for the UCI, but there was definitely an involvement after that successful campaign that Vero ran with Brian Cookson. It will be very interesting now to see whether their relationship with the IAAF in terms of marketing, communications, and telling a bit of a story, a bit more of a positive story, no pun intended, about the IAAF. It will be very interesting to see whether that carries on. Now that Seb Coe is in post.
Here's a quick thought before we move on from this topic. You mentioned, David, the General Secretary role is going to be a crucial one. Who will fill that? Obviously, Seb Coe has a big contacts book from his time at London 2012. A couple of key figures currently out of work, or out of sports work, certainly, from that event. A certain Paul Dighton, Chief Executive of London 2012. Probably not the role for him, but Debbie Jevons, another one who I'm sure we'll move on to in a minute, but she of course left her role running the England 2015 Rugby World Cup organisational effort. Could we see her showing up with Seb?
Possibly. I think one potential difficulty with somebody like that and another London 2012 person and another British person might be that
parochial.
Yeah, there may be a faction within the IAAF who, whether they voted for Coe or not, might want to have it recognised at the top table that this is a truly international organisation. So let's see. I mean, it's a good job with some easy wins, really. And there's some low-hanging fruit for a new General Secretary, despite all the difficulties that athletics is facing.
Yeah, I mean, you would expect potentially a Francophone candidate, or potentially someone with a little bit more of an international profile, perhaps, than a Debbie Jevons, or as David says, another low-cog veteran.
Well, Papadiak, Lamine's son, knows athletics well. So let's wait and see. Anyway, moving on. Owen, as editor of the magazine, you have just signed off, I believe, on the 80th edition of Sports Pro magazine. Congratulations to you.
Thank you.
Tell us what's in it.
Well, we have on the cover, we've got Brett Gosper, the chief executive of World Rugby, who is preparing for his first ever World Rugby World Cup. As chief executive.
It's so a mouthful.
It is. It's almost a palindromic tournament title, but we've got a pretty extensive preview of that, obviously with an interview, which I believe you did.
Yes, I did that. Let's talk about Brett very quickly before we move on to the rest of it. I spoke to Brett he was on a two-day break in France, his last holiday before getting into the bulk of tournament time, I suppose. And what struck me, obviously, you know, he talked the talk, everything, all the preparations have been put in place. He's expecting the biggest, most successful, best ever tournament that World Rugby, formerly IRB, has ever seen. But what struck me was, and this will be evident if listeners, you read the piece, it was quite how relaxed he was. For a man who is overseeing, as Owen says, his first Rugby World Cup, the major showpiece tournament of his federation, he was adamant. There was nothing keeping him awake at night. There were no nerves. It was absolutely nothing. And I think, actually, if you look at the preparations that have been put in place, not a lot has been left to chance. I mean, all the major sponsors were signed up over a year before the tournament. They're all returning partners from New Zealand, so they all have a good idea of exactly how they're going to be activating. All the TV deals were done ages ago as well, and at much higher values than they have been before. Tickets is going to be, it will be a record attended Rugby World Cup. I think they're on for, they've already gone through their target of 2.2 million tickets, and I think they're on for at least 2.4, 2.5, which would beat the record that was set in France in 2007. Obviously, we've mentioned Debbie Jevons before. There was clearly a bit of an issue there with the local organising team. The one thing that I think is going to cause them headache, well, two things that are going to cause them headaches, and we'll wait and see what it's like come tournament time. Transport issues. A lot of these games are on relatively late at night, and the transport infrastructure around these grounds hasn't necessarily been tested to the standard that they might have liked. Secondly, and the far bigger issue, is the secondary ticket market, which has been a long-running issue, and one that Brett Gosper was saying that World Rugby and England 2015 have done as much as they can do to solve, but ultimately they were not able to get the legislative changes that they wanted from the British government. So, touts are plenty, I suppose.
Yeah, it was an interesting test case for Britain's secondary ticketing legislation, or basically the attitude and the outlook of the CMS, but I know that World Rugby will be disappointed. I think on this occasion, and I don't really want to generalise, but the demographic that a Rugby World Cup is being pitched to, and particularly the kind of the corporate sector that will be courted by it, perhaps it won't be as much of a public relations storm as it might have been with another event. But it certainly is. It's not ideal. But I do think, looking at the tournament more widely, if you certainly go back to when Brett Gosper took over at World Rugby, and probably going back to the start of the decade that rugby has lined up for itself.
It's quite
something. They would have been looking at this tournament as something they would have wanted to absolutely maximise the commercial potential of. It is the banker, yeah. You know, you've got a big market in rugby terms, about the wealthiest market you can hit. You've got lots of world-class venues. It's in a good time zone, not for New Zealand, perhaps, and Australia, but for a lot of the kind of the casual viewership that you'd want to call. And it's also got the residual tournament and event hosting experience that England and the UK have built up in the last few years.
And I think you're in a mature sports business market in the UK, so in terms of sponsorship activation, my own view is, and I think, Owen, you and I have talked about this off the air before, I wonder if the commercial importance and status of the Rugby World Cup, certainly in the UK sports industry, is overstated sometimes, because it seems to me that every agency chief, brand director, commercial coordinator seems to be a huge rugby fan, which perhaps says something about the diversity of the industry.
The UK sports industry loves rugby.
Absolutely. So if you compare it with, and I know that in a previous Sports Pro you have compared it, you know, what is the world's third biggest sporting event? And there are various ways to measure that, so there's no clear answer. But again, if you compare the hype and the interest around the Rugby World Cup as compared to the World Athletics Championship, which is upcoming, then you see a huge difference. And partly that's where it's being staged, of course. But there is also this real rugby focus amongst some of the, or a large number, I would say, of the decision makers in the UK sports industry, which is fantastic for rugby.
I think it's easy to get blindsided by the strong rugby nations as well. I mean, obviously, the tournament being here in England, just something that sprang out of the Brett Gosper interview, he did pinpoint a few key markets outside of the traditional rugby markets and the traditional wealthy sports markets, I suppose, that world rugby are actively targeting. First of all, obviously, Brazil. And he did concede that the gains that have been made for rugby there are on the back of the sport's debut in the Olympics next year, of course, the first sevens tournament to be played, but tangible participation gains being recorded there. Perhaps more interestingly, certainly from a commercial perspective, Germany, he pinpointed as a market which is really waking up to rugby, and that has been propelled by some canny TV deals that have been struck there. There's quite a lot, a surprising amount of rugby on free-to-air TV in Germany. So he'll be hoping that will be propelled by the Rugby World Cup and by the Olympics next year. And finally, the USA. And there are huge efforts being made to capitalise on what is already the fastest growing participation market for rugby. The USA Sevens team has done quite well. It's winning tournaments now. Quite a lot is expected of the 15s team when they come over here next month for the Rugby World Cup. And there has been quite an interesting commercial link-up between the RFU, which is England's rugby union governing body, and USA Rugby. This sort of, it's not quite a joint venture, but USA Rugby has set up an arm's length commercial entity called Rugby International Marketing, and the RFU has taken a small financial stake in it and will offer strategic advice. And it seems to me that this entity is reminiscent of what Major League Soccer and USA Soccer did with Soccer United Marketing, have a separate arm's length commercial entity to exploit and evolve, exploit the rights and evolve the sport in a particular market. And that is, it looks to be what's going to happen with Rugby International Marketing.
I think the other key market, and it's an obvious one, is Japan.
Yeah.
Looking ahead to the 2019 World Cup, and obviously World Rugby has its issues at the moment in terms of the stadium for the final, which is probably a whole other topic that we don't necessarily want to get into now. But I suspect that a really successful performance by the Japanese team on the pitch will give a real boost to that tournament, which is obviously, you know, if you exclude New Zealand, which whilst a small market, is clearly an established rugby market, and they hosted in 2011. 2019 really will be the first time World Rugby has taken the World Cup to a truly emerging rugby nation, and I think there's probably a lot resting on the Japanese team.
And if you, I mean, we mentioned earlier that the UK sports industry was quite rugby focused. Interesting to note that the Japanese Olympic hierarchy are also very rugby focused. So, it's probably unique. It's almost certainly unique in the history of sport that President Mori, the president of the local organising committee for Tokyo 2020, is also the president for the local organising committee of the Rugby World Cup in 2019. And he is no spring chicken, so that is probably quite a heavy workload. Also, the new Japanese Olympic minister, Toshiaki Endo, is a huge rugby fan and a former rugby player. This is still a current rugby player. He plays in parliamentary rugby teams, and in fact, when I interviewed him out in Tokyo last year, the one thing he was looking forward to the most out of this exciting upcoming decade of sport for Japan was his visit to the UK for the Rugby World Cup this year, where he will get to play in the parliamentary rugby game before one of the games at the World Cup. So go Toshiaki.
You know, I do know that certainly Brett Gosper said that World Rugby have been disappointed that the stadium switch means that they won't have the opportunity to directly tie the Rugby World Cup to the Olympics.
That's I think that's a key distinction. A lot of people think it's just an infrastructural and a logistical planning thing why World Rugby are disappointed the stadium debacle, the Olympic stadium debacle in Tokyo, means that the Rugby World Cup will no longer be held at the centrepiece venue for the Olympics. But as you were saying, go on, it's about a sort of mental link.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I do think outside of those core markets, it must be fairly difficult for rugby to communicate just how big the Rugby World Cup is within those markets, if you see what I mean.
Mm.
But I also think that for Japan 2019, the performance of Japan's team and the performance of several teams at the Olympics will also be a pretty significant factor.
Mm.
And I don't think that World Rugby at the moment is going to be too disappointed if there's some kind of conflation of the interest in Sevens and the interest in Union. I know that they are making steps to commercialise Sevens as a sport in its own right, but I don't think it's quite as siloed at this point as, for example, the three formats in international in international cricket are.
It took Owen 23 minutes to mention cricket.
One more thing on rugby before we move on. Another feature in this magazine is in fact explicitly linked to a certain David Cushnan. Your new boss, David, I believe, John Stainer, is interviewed in the magazine. What's it all about?
Yes, he is. Repucom doing a lot of work with the around the Rugby World Cup. We've got a number of rugby clients, and
can you name them all?
No, and for client sensitivity reasons. Owen came along to our plush offices over on the other side of the outskirts of London, and interviewed John, and we're looking forward to some good positive feedback when people read it. I hear it's a cracking piece.
Sure. It's an Aladdin's cave of data over there at Repucom UK HQ. But the two things where I think the change in Repucom's outward image and its client proposition, I suppose, the term that John used in the interview was logo counters, that had been the external view of Repucom in recent years. That they went through various media trying to see how often sponsors appeared, how long they appeared for, etc. And the other thing that he was keen to talk about was that moving Repucom on from a company that you go to at the end of the sponsorship cycle and to the start. I mean, maybe you could tell us a bit more about that, David.
Yes, it's a full service offering, really, and it, you know, media evaluation is a key component of any sponsorship proposal or sponsorship activation, and Repcom still very much is in that business and at the forefront of that business. What is happening is an expansion out into areas such as consulting, which means that we can be part of the sponsorship journey, if you like, and that's for brands, rights holders, or even other agencies.
David, what's the biggest sport in Senegal?
Good question. I mean, we all remember the 2002 FIFA World Cup when Senegal
I believe that was
starred.
In Japan and South Korea.
It was, and we all remember it. But I'd have to say, if I was to choose, wrestling.
Correct. And there is a cracking piece on the intricate workings behind Senegalese wrestling in the next, well, the 80th edition of Sports Pro magazine. Moving on, Owen, elsewhere. We've got...
Is that the end of the
that's
discussion?
That's the end of the discussion. Okay. I mean, it's all about black magic and complicated sponsorship arrangements, and I really wouldn't feel like I was on safe legal ground discussing it at
complicated
length.
Promotional arrangements as well. This
very
very much more professional boxing than UFC.
Yes.
In terms of how it's structured.
But wildly popular. Absolutely wildly popular. It really is a terrific piece. But let's have this as a teaser rather than a spoiler. Owen, we have a special report, special feature in the magazine to celebrate the dawn of yet another new European soccer season. Mm. We've had a look at the major European soccer teams, so football, I suppose, we call football soccer here at Sports Pro, the European soccer teams and what they are doing to... promote their brands and get new fans in new markets. You spoke to some interesting people.
I did. In fact, we spoke to some interesting people across the Sports Pro team, and we actually looked maybe slightly beyond the obvious candidates, the Real Madrids, the Barcelonas, the Manchester United.
Boring.
Was it Chelsea?
It wasn't Chelsea. No, further back than that, we got in touch with Donna Maria Cullen at Tottenham Hotspur.
Yep.
Obviously, they have been busy this summer expanding their potential reach into new markets by signing a hosting deal with the NFL for 10 years from 2018 when they move into their, in no way provocatively, built 61,000-seater stadium in North London.
Arsenal's, of course, is
60.
Mm. Here's a quick question, Owen. Which will be more transformative? Tottenham's move into their new stadium, which will host NFL games, or West Ham's move into the old Olympic Stadium?
It's interesting because Tottenham, of course, will own that stadium and will have the rights to reap the benefits of all the other events that they will be putting on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think their plan for the NFL, in fact, is that they're going to have this retractable pitch, which means that they could conceivably play a Premier League game on a Saturday and an NFL game on a Sunday.
They've got two pitches, haven't they?
Yeah.
One grass, one plastic. Yeah.
But I think there is an interesting point there, talking about London as a sports event city, in that there's a finite number of concerts, other sporting events, beyond the resident teams, if you like, and you will, in 3-4 years' time, be in a situation where you've got Wembley, Twickenham, the Emirates Stadium, home of Arsenal, the new 61,000 capacity White Hart Lane 2, or whatever it's going to be called.
Chelsea are upgrading.
The Olympic Stadium as another venue. You know, that's before you even get into London's other venues, such as the major parks, which obviously both, Hyde Park certainly is a long-term concert venue. So you are it's an ultra-competitive situation.
Yeah.
And I just wonder... whether Spurs haven't actually played a bit of a masterstroke in terms of doing this deal with the NFL, because I don't see enough events to satisfy the needs of all those stadiums in about 3-4 years' time.
I think that's absolutely true, and I'm sure that's probably why they've gone all out. I mean, the new stadium design that they've issued from Populous is very much built to the spec required by the NFL. Mm. The other thing, of course, about Tottenham is that, unlike some of the other venues you've mentioned, transport links are more of an issue, and that's certainly something that the club have been trying to resolve in concert with the local authorities. But certainly it's interesting for them, not only in that it brings those events in, it makes whatever the new stadium is called an international name in a way that it might not have been otherwise through that partnership with the NFL. Some other people we spoke to for this feature, we spoke to a gentleman called Suresh Lechmanan from Borussia Dortmund, who have set up an office in Singapore in the last 12 months. I think it was October last year that they established it. And one of the things that he was talking about at quite some length was the need for clubs really not to just do the quick hit. It can't just be whether it's social media, whether it's international broadcasting, or whether it's an international tour. There has to be some kind of official presence for clubs in these international markets they're trying to hit throughout the year.
Suresh was also talking about the benefits of, so the reason that they've gone into Singapore, of course it's the Asian market, but Asia is huge. But why Singapore? It's because the Bundesliga office is also there, and one of their main sponsors, Evonik, also has a headquarters there.
Well, they're actually operating, I think, more or less out of the Evonik office.
Okay.
Or certainly very, very close by.
Yeah.
And yet that's definitely...
But it's this concerted effort which really shone through. And I think that's something... I mean, I think that's probably unique in terms of leagues and teams working together. I mean, we also spoke to Tom Greenwood, who's head of partnerships at the Premier League. And the Premier League, obviously, different model from the Bundesliga, but they've gone out and they've done events in different, in new markets. They've been running the, is it every 2 years, the Asia Trophy, the Barclays Asia Trophy, and that's been funded and put on through the Premier League's title sponsorship deal with Barclays. That deal is coming to a close at the end of this year, and the Premier League is tweaking its commercial model so that it no longer has a title deal. And what Tom Greenwood was saying was that's going to leave them with some work to do, some challenges to overcome in order to maintain the presence that they have as a league in these. Obviously, they have a presence through broadcast, but physically to have a presence there without the title sponsor taking a lot of the financial burden, they're going to have to work hard to overcome those challenges.
But do you not think there's going to be a point where, because we've just been through the period of 6-7 weeks where there are pre-season friendlies, which are sort of masquerading as competitive leagues or tournaments around the world, in Asia, in the United States, involving almost exclusively European teams who are using it as part of their pre-season. Is there not going to be a point where there's renewed calls for genuinely competitive elements, whether it's the early stages of cup competitions or... it's a bit semi-competitive, but the Community Shield or the Super Cups that are played across Europe to be played elsewhere. I know it happens in, I think, the Italian Super Cup. And it was interesting, it happened the other way only last week when the Saudi Super Cup was actually played in London.
Yeah.
So, that's where there's going to be a real pushback, I think, fans.
Very quickly on that Saudi thing, the Saudi sort of season opening game was played at Fulham's ground, I think.
I think it was Queen's Park Rangers.
Queen's Park Rangers ground. And one of the reasons that they did that, apparently, was to encourage women and children to go. And by all accounts, there were plenty of women and children in the crowd, because, of course, women can't go to football games in Saudi.
But I think it's going to be, I think we're not too far away now from the point where fans in places like the United States and certain parts of Asia are not going to be satisfied enough. Their thirst will not be quenched enough by a pre-season friendly, because they will know enough to know that it's an exhibition game. And I think it works at the moment, and I suppose the clubs and the leagues would say, look, the stadiums are full, we're selling out every time. But I think there will come a point, and we're not too far away from it, where there will be a push for more, and then you're going to get a little bit of friction, I think.
I think that's definitely on the way. I mean, one of the problems that European clubs have is that every single major European league operates a pure league system. So taking a regular season game, moving it to the US or China, means lots of teams are at a competitive disadvantage. The 39th game obviously is a concept that the Premier League tried to create to get around that a few years ago. That created another problem, which is, well, one of two teams are playing for a significant position in the league. One gets a weak team or a team with, you know, their flip-flops on. Mm. The other one gets a very strong team. But I do think that something will come of that. I think that the Shield games are an obvious way around that. That's what the Italians have already pursued. I wouldn't be surprised if Spain was next. They're doing an awful lot of work in markets like China. They're doing a lot more unified work in recent years.
I think in England there's a problem in that they need to play games at Wembley. Yeah. There are no easy answers.
Yeah, that actually for the Premier League, who will, now that they're not working with a title sponsor, will start looking at these things again. For the Premier League and for the FA, you do have the issue with Wembley. It means that, for example, playing the League Cup final, that's another game that's another event you've got to replace, and so on and so on. But I do think you're right. I do think at some point that will.
There is an easy answer, actually, David.
Tell me.
Yeah, it's just a slight format tweak. But what you do is you have a mid-season playoff. So whoever is in the top 6 to 8 positions at the midway point, you halt the league. The rest of the teams can have their much-craved mid-season break. You take those 8 teams away to different locations around the world. There's no question of competitive disadvantage because, you know, they're all taken away. They're drawn against each other, 8th place, first, whatever, however a playoff works. And you do those in markets all around the world. You bring them back. They're at a disadvantage because they'll be tired, but, you know, they'll be the richest, biggest team, so they should have big enough squads to deal with that. And then away they go with the rest of the season. It doesn't affect league positions at all, but they've won the mid-season playoff. There you go, football administrators.
It's another flawless idea. Yeah.
And you've not copyrighted that idea, so they can have that for free.
That's true, yeah. I've taken it ever so slightly from the current format for the J-League, which is, I think the J-League actually runs over 3 distinct bits of the season, which is madness. But it's all done in Japan. But
my question would be, when is the J-League coming to the UK?
The UK League? Well, yeah, correct. We all want them here. Let's move away from soccer, shall we? Unless you have do you have something else you want to say on that?
We're moving the conversation away.
We are moving the conversation away. A special report that we have in this 80th edition of Sports Pro magazine. It's our annual special report on stadiums and venues. Collection of all sorts of fantastic material on the technical side of hosting infrastructure, I would say.
Yeah.
And there's one rather special piece, Owen.
There's a couple actually, and it's worth pointing out at this stage that all of this material, of course, is available on the SportsPro website.
Indeed, www.sportspromedia.com.
It's part of our Stadiums and Venues Week.
Mm.
There are 2 main features on this. One is Euro 2016 and the progress of that stadium construction project. But of course, we've moved away from football now.
Yes.
So we will look at the other feature, which is looking at 10 stadiums.
Can I just interject there? Just on Euro 2016 venues, it's worth sports industry stadium watchers. If any of you are interested in how the Olympic Stadium is going to be managed and operated, once West Ham move in there, it's being run by a company called Vinci, a French company that runs the Stade de France. They are managing and operating and doing all sorts of bits and pieces for a large portion of the Euro 2016 venue. So keep your eyes peeled. Owen.
Yeah. So elsewhere, no Vinci stadiums in this particular list.
No.
I don't think there are any. Misspoken.
Possibly but the
I'll have a look on the website.
Absolutely. 10 venues basically that create unusual or sensible solutions to difficult problems.
Okay.
That face venue operators.
10 venues of invention.
Mm. So some interesting names on there. The Nassau Coliseum,
yep.
which has been taken over recently by the Barclays Center team.
Yeah, I actually spoke to Brett Yormark, chief executive of the Brooklyn Nets and the Barclays Center, for this little piece on the Nassau Coliseum. Not necessarily a spectacular venue. You wouldn't look at it and I suppose it's going to be quite nice, but it's not amazing. But the inventive thing about this stadium is the team behind it that will be running it. It's really a signal, I think, that the Brooklyn Nets, the ownership structure behind the Brooklyn Nets, is really emerging as a true sports and entertainment venue operator, and it's modelling itself very much along the same lines as AEG, for example. And they've just expanded into, they've opened an office on the West Coast in LA, and I think as sports industry trends go, that will be one to watch. I think we can, they're ambitious, they're growing, and you know now they've got scale, and so I think we can expect to see a lot of those guys in the market.
Moving on to some of the other names on that list, we have the Estadio Castelao from the FIFA World Cup in Brazil last year.
What's special about this one, Owen?
Well, cynics will point out it was the only Brazilian venue to be completed to time and to budget last year.
When you say cynics, Owen, do you mean you?
Would you mean me?
yes, but carry on.
It's a standard bearer for...
It's got special bogs, hasn't it?
It's got special bogs, yeah. It's got the world's largest vacuum sanitary installation, to put it as euphemistically as possible. So basically a big aeroplane toilet.
So, yeah, I mean, it's one for perhaps the team behind the Glastonbury Festival to
perhaps.
Take a
look at. On a more serious point, Brazil is facing... some point large scale challenges with its water quality and its water quantity basically at the moment as it expands as an economy and as a country and these are the kind of solutions it saves a hell of a lot of water by using a vacuum system instead of a water based one and it's also in concert with a lot of other waste management and water management systems of other kinds.
All sorts of other interesting venues on this list. There's one in Belarus, one in Guadeloupe, Mexico. Of course, there's one of the Euro 2016 venues. It really is worth checking out online. David?
Oh, there's some nice pictures to go with.
There's plenty of beautiful,
great text.
Beautiful pictures. Some unexpected venues in there. And I know there are a lot of... I think Stadium Porn, it is on Twitter. It's very popular Twitter site, and clearly a lot of people are interested in this sort of thing. So do check it out either online, sportswearmedia.com.
And there's lots of different facets as well, and one thing we've tried to kind of get away from is just looking at the shiniest or the most technologically advanced and look at maybe building practices,
financing.
Yeah.
Yeah, bit of everything. One final topic for discussion before we sign off this podcast. Things have been happening in the Olympic movement. It was just a couple of weeks ago that the IOC selected Beijing as the host of the 2022 Winter Olympics, a renowned winter sports city, of course, Beijing. The city defeated first-time bidder Almaty from Kazakhstan in an IOC vote in Kuala Lumpur at the end of July. Following that, there's a bit of moving and shaking in what's shaping up to be a very interesting race for the 2024 Summer Olympics. First off, I want to put a couple of questions to you guys. The Beijing decision... hasn't necessarily gone down that well across the world's media. Owen, the IOC was sort of between a rock and a hard place with that one, weren't they?
They were a little bit. I mean, one of the things that dominated the build-up was the number of democracies that were dropping out of the race, which left us with Almaty and Beijing, which was due, as far as the IOC is concerned, to a kind of conflation of two different figures that were attached to the Sochi Winter Olympics.
I think that was the headline reason, yeah.
But also, you didn't have a kind of Winter Olympics romantics choice there. There wasn't a real winter sports destination in that race either.
Mm.
I think what's interesting is that Almaty is not known at all, really, as a host of major events, but still managed to get within four votes of Beijing, which
I think
suggests that there were a lot of members who were...
It was the only one of the two that has snow.
Well, there's that, exactly.
And I think it was the only one of the two that really had adapted to fit the IOC's more cost-efficient Agenda 2020 agenda. Although the IOC, perhaps predictably, perhaps because they had to, after Beijing, insisted that both cities had adapted their bids quite heavily to try and take in some of the Agenda 2020 recommendations. This is a bidding race that began before those Agenda 2020 reforms passed.
Well, it's worth pointing out that those Agenda 2020 reforms were in fact spurred, catalysed by the initial part of this Winter Olympic bidding race.
Yes, absolutely. And I think what you mentioned the competitiveness or likely competitiveness of the 2024 Summer Olympics bidding race. I think what will be very interesting will be a true test of how successful these Agenda 2020 reforms will not be actually that race, because I think my own suspicion is that the IOC may find that they were dealing with a Winter Olympics problem rather than an Olympic hosting problem in general, because all the evidence from the 2024 bids, yes, there's been the Boston issue, but Los Angeles looks as though it will step in. You have a very strong contender in Paris. You have Germany bidding perhaps with the wrong city, but
Hamburg
are in, and Hamburg beat up Berlin. And you have a new contender in Budapest, and you might have Toronto and who knows, maybe one or two others. I think what will be interesting...
Worth saying that there are a couple of referendums coming up there, aren't there? That Hamburg will have a referendum next year.
That is true. I think at the end of this year.
That is
absolutely true. But let's see what the 2026 Winter Olympic bidding race, and I know we're a long way away from that, brings, because I think the acid test is, can the IOC persuade Oslo to come back, Munich to maybe bid again if Hamburg doesn't win, an American city if Los Angeles doesn't win, Salt Lake City has talked about it. A Winter Olympics, it seems to me, is actually a more complex puzzle. It's a smaller event, but as much as people talk about the lack of legacy possibilities with a new Olympic stadium with an athletics track, it's more easy, I think, it's easier to create a legacy there than for a bobsleigh track, for example. So you are dealing with, I think, more specific venues, and you have the issues of potentially two different clusters, at least two. I think there's three in Beijing's successful bid. So let's just hold fire see whether...
There are two other issues, I think, that the Winter Olympics faces in its current form. One is that winter sports are not as global as summer sports, because you need snow, you need ice, you need things that don't naturally appear in lots of countries around the world for much of the year at all.
Mm.
The other thing is, as you say, that legacy thing, the vision thing. If you look at the difference between what the proposed legacy of London 2012 was going to be, that you're transforming a corner of a neglected corner of London, that you're creating a lot of community facilities for the public to use, that you're trying... they haven't perhaps succeeded as they might have done, or might have wanted to inspire more people to do sport. That is an easier sell than what Sochi were trying to do, which is we're going to create a fairly high-end holiday resort, basically, and try and make Sochi a centre in the same way that Verbier is a centre, or in the same way that Val d'Isère is. It's not quite as... it doesn't have the same broad appeal.
And in fairness to Beijing, their bid is centred around a desire to create a new winter sports hub, and there's there's obviously a huge young demographic in China and around the Beijing area, no doubt, who are interested in, or you know, or could be persuaded to take up winter sports, whether that's skiing, snowboarding, or whatever. So there's, you know, it would be wrong to suggest that this Beijing bid is not without some plus points, in that they have created a reason to host the games. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, as with all mega event legacies, and particularly Olympic legacies, the success or failure of that comes years after the actual event. So again, we'll have to hold fire on that. But I think it's you're right. It was an underwhelming race, but actually quite fascinating to see the changing global dynamics and which countries were choosing to bid. And from the IOC's point of view, they've got to be hoping that Los Angeles comes in strong, that Paris stays the course, that the German bid from Hamburg is a really strong, interesting contender, and that Budapest
gets a narrative.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think, Budapest is hosting the next World Aquatics Championship. So, each is creating their story. And if you've got four strong bidders, and remember the bidding rules are changing as well, so that all four bidders, barring a major crisis, will go through to the final stage. That just by having four in the final, or maybe five, maybe six, it creates a bit more of a positive impression for the IOC and a bit interest.
Just a quick technical thing, the deadline for submission of a bid is the 15th of September, is that right?
Yeah, I think
so. Then this is the 2024 race, and then a decision will be taken in the summer of 2017.
In Lima, yeah. I think the other interesting thing about the race that's emerging for 2024 is you have some really quite different cities, and this will be an interesting test of the Agenda 2020 reforms, which are trying to shake up what you see as an Olympic host. It doesn't have to be the kind of ultra-compact format for a venue cluster or set of venue clusters that we've seen in the past. Which means that you could have Los Angeles and Paris, or Los Angeles and Budapest, or two very different cities.
And let's remember, one of the bids for the 2022 Winter Olympics that didn't make it, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was a joint bid between Slovakia and Poland, and that was, ditched certainly around the time of the Agenda 2020 reforms. But actually,
it's a long way before,
was it? Well, but that actually demonstrates the kind of new thinking that might be appropriate for either a summer or winter games in the future. It's a different model, but it's a model that probably shouldn't be immediately discounted.
I think for the winter games anyway, there needs to be a long-term idea of what the winter games is for. Do you want something that serves what is a substantial winter sports community? And games that can be held either in a small space in a traditional winter sports area or across different areas? Or do you want something that is a January, February version of the summer games and is a huge all-encompassing event?
Mm, indeed. Final word on this Olympic process, 2024. At this stage, Owen, who's your money on?
I think it's quite hard to call now because Los Angeles has come back in, but definitely Paris will be very pleased with what's been going on in the US recently. I think they will all fancy their chances in a bigger way than they did before.
And who's behind that bid, the storytelling?
Vino?
Yes, a certain Mike Lee at Vero. David, who's your money on?
I think Paris will win, but I wouldn't discount Hamburg, and I think let's not forget the nationality of the president of the IOC, who is pretty all-powerful still, and that might just help swing a few votes Hamburg's way. I don't think they'll win, but I think they'll probably do better than expected.
I think if as long as they do indeed declare and bid, I think LA will win, and that is that. Right, thank you very much, gentlemen. That is the end of this Sports Pro podcast. Join us again whenever we do the next one. It could be another 2-year hiatus. But Owen Connolly, thank you very much.
Thank you, James.
And David Cushman, thank you very much.
Pleasure.